The Guardian.
Här kommer Hart ut för att nicka undan bollen mot Ibrahimovic som går in och vinner och försöker med en cykelspark.
Han gör
en volleybicykleta, ett cirkusnummer och ett artisteri som är fullständigt obegripligt. Det är fullständigt obegripligt.
Football Weekly Extra.
Messi, Ronaldo, Grant Holm, amateurs. For among us, not of us, walks Zlatan. England fans came to barrack at Brahma. He left them ragged, raw, yet in their own small way, grateful to have serviced his genius. The pod salutes the man who pulled off one of the greatest feats in football, silencing Alan Green, but says, greatest goal ever, it wasn't even Zlatan's greatest goal ever. Elsewhere, there's a roundup of the other midweek fun. Cruyff and Ronaldo speak. We hear firsthand and exclusively from the men who spoke to them. And we look forward to the weekend's action, where West Brom face Chelsea, QPR, Southampton and Arsenal Spurs, and where many players will score but not celebrate, because their goals are rubs compared to Zlatan. Football Weekly Extra. Hello, everybody. Producer Ben proudly announces the sexiest pod ever, starring Barry Glendinning.
Yeah, I think I might be
lowering
the tone.
No, Barry. No. Hmm? Not at all. Pedro Pinto. CNN's Pedro Pinto.
Hola.
Hola. Hey. And Guten Tag, Raphael Honigstein.
Hello.
From too many places to list, really.
Indeed.
Along with me and along with one of the sexiest goals ever scored. What an extraordinary night there in the Friends Arena in Stockholm. England 2-1 up. England fans singing, "You're just a Andy Carroll." And then, Barry.
And then Ibra stepped up and scored a sensational goal. Reaction, Twitter almost broke because of it. And the reaction, my personal reaction, I burst out laughing when he did it. I just thought it was sensational. Other people were stunned into silence. The superlatives have been rolling out all night. And it was great that he scored the first goal in Sweden's new stadium. And he said that was his favourite because it, you know, was the first goal of the stadium. But fourth was undoubtedly the best. Just an absolutely fantastic goal. And we could be mealy-mouthed and blame it on Joe Hart, but I think that would be unfair.
Barney Rono tweeting in saying, a lot of people convinced Zlatan actually meant that goal. Watch it again. It's clear he was trying to put the ball out to waste time. Top stuff from Barney. It was an extraordinary goal. As you say, he scored more than one. Four, in fact. Pedro.
Incredible. I don't want to just be redundant and repeat what a lot of people said, but the audacity he had to even try it was incredible. And the Swedish manager said it was a goal straight out of a video game, and that's exactly what it was. And I particularly like the fact that we got to see all of Zlatan's tattoos.
Mm, absolutely. And a booking, of course, which is it's a bit of a shame, that isn't
it? Well-deserved booking, yeah. I mean, it was really pleasing evening for him, not just for the goals, not just for the result, but he's finally really done something that's obviously much more important than winning these trophies with small clubs. He scored against an English team, and we all know that is the true mark of every player. And
he has scored against Arsenal before.
Well, like Lionel Messi before, he was, I think, tortured by this inability to score against English sides. But the problem is now he's back with another problem, which is people say he's just a flat-track bully.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Indeed. The greatest goal ever debate? Yeah, I'm going to say that he's done some
it's
things.
Not the greatest goal ever.
No. All right.
Have you seen Tyson's goal for Metalist Charkov last week?
No, I haven't.
It's a copy of Van Basten's goal for Holland in
right.
the 88 European final.
I've not seen that. How was that?
Van Basten himself said he prefers Tyson's version of it. So it's a cover version.
Right.
It's actually better than the original.
So rare that happens, isn't it?
It's really brilliant.
Right.
Really worth watching.
Why do you think Van Basten reckoned that Tyson's was better?
Well, it could possibly be because the camera angle's a little bit more pleasing and, you know, advanced, and it looks more exciting. But he just smashes the ball with the outside of his boot. From a bit further out, the cross comes in with more pace, and it just hits the right corner and almost kind of stays inside the net. It's just gorgeous.
Was it in the final of the European Championships? it wasn't. Sorry, my mistake. Interesting. Okay. What was your greatest goal ever, Pedro? Not yours that you scored, but what would you put as your greatest goal ever?
Maradona's goal.
Well, against England.
Okay, yeah.
Because that was against England. That's the thing.
I watched it the other day. repeatedly again, and it was just, yeah, I was 11 at the time as well, so it's the kind of era when everything...
Who were you supporting, Pedro, can I ask?
No one, really.
Right,
I was
football.
Just watching, yeah.
Yeah.
I was just watching. But it was funny that Zlatan's goal was scored on the day that FIFA released the shortlist for the best Puskás goal award for 2012, wasn't it? Because now it won't be there, and it was probably the best.
Will you be doing
that,
Pedro?
No, not this year.
Oh.
Not this year.
Okay. Who've they got?
Jimbo's antennae start twitching. Gig.
It's probably Ruud Gullit. He did it last year.
Okay.
So...
Right. I wasn't aware of this. They have a Ferenc Puskás award for the best goal of the year.
Yeah, and the shortlist of 10 came out yesterday.
And anyone special on that?
Yeah, a lot of special people. Falcao, he scored an incredible goal in a friendly in Mexico. The Neymar's there as well. Yeah. I mean, a lot of fantastic goals,
right.
But Zlatan's won't be there because it wasn't in the period.
Right.
It's interesting because I think that kind of the fashion and taste also change with time when it comes to goals. Because I think Maradona in 86 was so unusual because those kind of dribbling goals had gone out of fashion for, well, since the 50s probably, because people, teams were positionally much better and very hard, and there was a lot less space available. But now I think we almost see it every week from Messi, and I think there's a sense that kind of strikes and crazy acrobatics are more exciting than going past 10 players, because that's really what he does all the time.
Against Getafe. I mean, I don't think he does that all the time. I mean, come on, you're talking about 7 players or 8 Maradona went by, like Messi did against Getafe, which was incredible as well, the similarities between those goals, but I don't think you see it all the time. I'd love to see it all the time.
Barry, what goal would you like to see all the time?
Well, the best goal I've ever seen live was scored by Scott Sinclair for Plymouth against Barnet. He was only a kid, 17 at the time. It was sensational.
This was the game you went to see in person with James Dart, is that right?
Yeah, and it was a kind of a Maradona-esque beat 6 or 7 players and then rifle it into the net from a ridiculous angle.
Right.
But Zlatan's was, you know, completely different because it's a moment of individual brilliance, capitalising on a defensive error, the kind of thing that Jonathan Wilson really wouldn't like at all, particularly as it ended in a goal, which he doesn't, isn't a huge
fan
of.
A goal represents something going wrong, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you're actually there in person, George Weah's famous Maradona-esque dribble against Verona, I was good fortune
really
to be
a dribble,
present.
Though? Well, no. I think he went in a kind of a straight line.
He
almost just
ran, basically. Yeah. Because Rob Smythe always says, I love goals that I've seen, when I see a goal and I've never seen anything like it before. That's what makes a goal special for him. And there was a goal scored by a defender called Giuseppe Biava of Palermo. And this is going back to about 2006. But perhaps producer Ben will put a hyperlink to a very bad bit of replay, where he basically, he's in the box and he tumbles forward, but does a kind of 360-degree spin, in the process of which he backheels, while upside down, the ball into the opposition net, can I stress, not his own. And that's pretty special. Right. Enough on good goals? There's loads of great Ibra ones out there, by the way. There are loads of truly astonishing Ibra. You've probably seen them all by now. As for England, what about them? They were 2-1 up. Were they actually not doing too badly at this point?
They were poor enough in the first half, passing going astray and all that. Again, it's a friendly, don't want to read too much into it. I thought some of the players did quite well, some of the debutants did well, and you know, it's nice for them to sort of get a handle on the international experience away from home, what it's like to travel with England. I don't think any of them did badly apart from Ryan Shawcross, who had a rather shock. Sorry?
You're leaving Joe Hart out of your playing badly. Is this the Umar?
Sorry, I meant
you've joined
debutants.
The conspiracy.
Well, the Joe Hart, we called him out on Monday saying he's making a lot of mistakes and he had a terrible, terrible game last night. But now I think the Joe Hart backlash has begun in earnest and people are going way over the top. You know, he is not a bad goalkeeper, but he's going through a patchy run of form at the moment that is quite alarming.
Do you think the praise went to his head a bit, that it's made him make decisions that he would otherwise not have made?
I don't know Joe Hart. I don't know what kind of guy he is. He seems nice and level-headed, but perhaps if people keep telling you you're great, you're going to start believing it eventually. I give you as my...
Have you heard that from someone?
Exhibit A, Bono.
Right.
Joe Hart is a great goalkeeper, and every great goalkeeper has a patch where he struggles. I mean, even Casillas has been criticized by the Real Madrid supporters this year. Petr Cech had a bad run. Buffon had a bad run. They all do. It's how you bounce back. I mean, England are average, and I'm just more concerned about the overrated players constantly coming out, like Sterling. I mean, can this guy do anything except run?
Sterling is 17 years old. It's too early to judge him, but yeah, he's far from a world beater.
He can take on men and beat them.
The fact that him and Wilfried Zaha are now being, their praises are being sung. It's the usual total media overreaction, and it always happens, and it's unfair on the players. It's sort of an insult to the intelligence of readers, and there's not really much you can do about it, I think.
But why do you play Sterling and not Lennon when Lennon is the finished article of Sterling?
Lennon isn't the finished article. Lennon, I think, is a dreadful player. The only thing he has is pace. And I think, who was it?
That's Sterling.
I think Sterling is more upstairs than Lennon. Somebody famously said if you took away Lennon's pace, he wouldn't get a game in a League Two side, and I agree. That's the only thing he has, speed.
I think that's tough. I think that's tough on him.
In other bad news for England, meanwhile, Montenegro moved top of their qualifying group because sneaky old FIFA slipped in a couple of qualifying matches for unobservant pod presenters. And there was Montenegro beating San Marino 3-0. They're now 2 points clear of England, having played the same number of games. Northern Ireland, you probably noticed, had a home game against Azerbaijan in qualifying Group F, and that was a 1-1 draw there at Windsor Park. Japan!
That's so Northern Ireland. They put in a heroic performance in Lisbon against Portugal, get a draw, possibly could have won, and then go and draw it home to Azerbaijan.
There were some astonishing misses in that game as well.
So I believe, and they only equalised in the 6th minute of injury time. So.
Ooh. All right. Japan are on the brink of becoming the first nation to qualify for the 2014 World Cup following a 2-1 win over Oman in Muscat. Alberto Zaccheroni's Blue Samurai. And Uzbekistan, who have never qualified for a World Cup finals, are now top of a congested Group A over there in Asia, with a surprise 1-0 success over Iran in Tehran. Did you see that game, Rafa?
I didn't.
All right. Perhaps you were watching all the thrills and spills from the Amsterdam Arena.
There weren't any.
Were there none?
Hardly.
Oh, what happened? It was a bit of a disappointment, this game, wasn't it? Netherlands-Germany.
It was. Well, the first half, you could say, tactically quite exciting because both teams were playing an incredibly high line and everyone's waiting for that one killer pass to beat the offside trap. It didn't quite happen. Robin had a chance, then slipped. Germany had 1-2 half chances. They were playing even without a striker. So some people saying Löw's obsession with Spain has really not gone to his head, not even a strike on the pitch. In fairness, both Gomez and Klose were out injured, so there aren't actually that many real number nines left, and it was as good an opportunity as any to test Götze, and sometimes Royce was playing up there. It was an interesting...
Podolski?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Podolski didn't even make the starting 11, and you'd think if there was ever a chance for him to play back in his favoured position as a centre-forward, this really was it. But Löw said he doesn't see him in that role anymore, and that really doesn't bode well for him, because on the left he's increasingly being marginalised by the likes of Götze and Royce, who can play right out there as well. It's going to be tough for him, I think.
Anyway, we could talk about that for hours, but we're not going to. Scotland won in Luxembourg. Debut win there on the bench for Billy Stark. We mentioned Northern Ireland. Ireland themselves lost at home to Greece, Barry.
The most interesting thing about that game was that Michel Platini was in Dublin to present the award to the FAI for the Irish being the bestest fans in the world.
Really?
And it was rather ironic that he did so in a stadium that was almost completely empty because nobody could be bothered going to the game.
Were your prediction being fulfilled in this sense? Because you were telling them if they didn't start picking some more attractive players that they would be greeted with empty stadiums wherever.
Well, if they didn't start doing better. Wes Hoolihan got a run out from Trapattoni last night and did okay, I think. That was interesting.
That's it for part one, then. Coming up in part two, some very, very exclusive interview news and FA Cup, MK Dons, AFC Wimbledon drama and more. Oh, yeah, Raphael Honigstein just pointed out Italy lost at home, which, you're having a bit of a snigger about, but the fact is, They don't care. They don't care, Rafa. Cesare Prandelli has lost seven friendlies.
They told us it was like a derby playing France.
Yeah. Do you know, they haven't beaten France at home. This is extraordinary. For 50 years. 50! And the game did feature an extraordinary goal by Mathieu Valbuena. I don't know if you've seen this. Mm-hmm. Very nice. Very nice. Anyway, a 2-1 win there for France. Great stuff for Didier Deschamps. But yeah, Prandelli, he's lost seven friendlies so far. How many official matches, competitive matches has he lost?
One.
And it was the final against Spain in Euro 2012. So, interesting. Pedro, you've been a busy chap. I wonder if you've been off doing more of your celebrity interviewing type thing.
It's been a good run. Persistence pays off. After 6 years waiting for Mourinho.
Right.
That's called stalking, not persistence.
It depends how you do it. What
he made you wait 6 years.
Into the window. That
Seriously?
Doesn't count as stalking, surely.
6 years?
Yeah, it was a long time. Yeah, to get that kind of access with him,
right.
It was a long time.
Okay.
Plus, he was upset with me for a long time as well.
Was he? Why?
Yeah, because I didn't vote for him on a poll. And
surely,
he
he's too big to take that kind of thing seriously.
Yeah, yeah. With Ronaldo, we had 5 minutes here, 6 minutes there,
right.
At promotional events, but this was the first time I actually got a chance to do a proper sit-down interview with him at one of his friends' house. And we talked about everything. We released part of the interview on CNN last week where he talked about his image and the problems that he has in the way people see him as being arrogant and acting in a particular distant way on the pitch. And it was the first time publicly I heard him admit that he has an image problem.
Right.
And he may have been a victim of that when the award season comes around.
Oh, that's what's holding him back. Okay. How did he kind of explain that? How did he equate his own image of himself with what other people see of him?
He said that he can't stand losing, and that's why he's so serious on the field, and that's why he takes everything in such an intense way and doesn't have maybe as much fun as he should and doesn't give that image that he's there doing something he loves to do. I personally think he does have an issue with that, and he admitted that maybe he does. He said that he hates constantly being recognized everywhere and not having a normal life. And in a special half-hour documentary that we're releasing on Friday, he talks about other things like his relationship with Ferguson, being a father, dating a supermodel, and he loosens up a little bit and talks about what he likes to do. And
throw us a little tidbit.
A little tidbit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he doesn't believe Ferguson is the best manager he's worked with,
Ooh.
Even though he keeps in touch with him all the time, and he's
right.
like his father in football.
Right. Is Jose, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, all right then. Rafa, you wanted to...
Well, I was interested because Pedro has told us, I think, before that Ronaldo is not the Ronaldo we sometimes see on the pitch. But the thing is, it's so difficult to square his view that it's all just an image problem based on sort of a distorted version of reality. When just a couple of days before the interview, he had this game at Dortmund where Dortmund took the lead, then he equalized, and his reaction wasn't to celebrate, but to shush the crowd and, you know, to gesticulate to everyone that they should be quiet. And I mean, why? Why? If you're a truly great player, have you ever seen Messi do that? I mean, maybe at the Bernabeu, but what's Dortmund to him? Why that reaction?
He did that against Barcelona in the title game last season, and it was appropriate because it was the goal that decided the title, and it was at your rival's home. It was completely ridiculous to do it to Dortmund. I thought exactly the same thing you did, and it was a goal which wasn't even decisive for anything, and it was a drawing goal, and then they lost the game. Why do that? I completely agree, and I will say it again though. Off the pitch, he's been the same since the first time I met him 8 years ago. Nice, humble, considering he's a superstar footballer and a really good guy.
What was the biggest surprise you had in that interview? Not necessarily something he said, but just something about him.
The fact that he realizes he has a problem and that it hurts his feelings. Because
right.
in the past, he's always said, if people don't like me, that's their problem. Mm. And this was the first time maybe he thought otherwise, or he said otherwise.
All right. How about his French lessons? Are they going well?
I don't think he's going there.
No, Paris Saint-Germain?
No, I don't think so. No, come on. Money isn't everything, especially when you have as much as he already does. And why else would he want to go to France?
Did he ever resolve this I'm feeling unhappy bit?
Oh, yeah.
publicly?
Well, publicly, I don't think he did.
No.
Privately, did he?
This was back in September when he came out and he said, I'm not happy and I know why, but I'm not going to say publicly.
Yeah, but there was talk of Real Madrid issuing a press release, which never appeared, and we haven't heard from him about this since.
I can tell you what I think and what I know as far as on the record. There are three reasons for that. First of all, he lost another major award. And every time he's up for an award on a stage, it's him versus two Barcelona players, and he feels the odd one out. Second one is he feels that at Real Madrid, there isn't the same kind of support for him as a player that Messi has at Barcelona. So when Marcelo or Casillas or Sergio Ramos come out and talk about the best player in the world, they don't say it's him, and he has an issue with that. And then the fact that he isn't, I think, also a captain at Real Madrid and one of the leaders in the dressing room. I think he still feels like there's a big split there between the Spanish players and the internationals, and he would like to have Florentino Perez internally or publicly say that Cristiano is one of our leaders.
Well, of course, since you met with... I noticed that since you met up with Ronaldo, he's sporting a big bandage over one eye, Pedro. I'm not sure if the... But,
he lost his vision during halftime. And when he scored against Levante, he did it with one eye because the other one was closed. Yeah. Right.
Amazing, amazing stuff. Sid Lowe will be joining us, we think, a little bit later on. Rafael, though...
Yes?
Bundesliga ahoy. Now, I mentioned the Dortmund donut before, which I'm not sure is exactly what it's called.
It's not the technical term.
What's the technical term for
football
it?
Footballnaut.
And what does that mean?
Nothing. It's just a made-up word.
Oh, a football
like
nout.
Astronaut.
But and a football nout. And this is basically a very super high-tech advanced cage with illuminating panels. And it's a 360 football reflex machine type thing.
Correct. Mm. It is.
All
Any
right.
questions?
Well, and they want to bring it to the Premier League because it's clearly the future. Is it the future?
Who
ever?
Wants to bring it to the Premier League?
Arsenal?
Really?
Well, maybe not. Chelsea do. Somebody else.
Is it a future? Well, it's definitely an interesting way to train because one thing it does give you is real data. I mean, if you're just training with players on the pitch, you can, if you're a very good coach, you can say they're improving or they're not improving.
Right.
But this really is a very hard workout, but also gives you numbers at the end of it. So if, you know, somebody like Götze can hit the perfect spot or the spot you want them to hit every single time on the volley, you know he's doing something right, whereas the other guy, you know, might have to go spend another hour in there.
The ball can come in from four different places, and there are, I don't know how many, maybe 30 different squares that can illuminate that he then has to put the ball into.
And what it trains is really the two, probably the, arguably the two most important things, and things that are very difficult to train otherwise, which is...
Running and pointing and shouting.
Yeah, exactly. The exact opposite of that, which is being aware of where you have to play the ball without seeing it. So, you know, something will light up before the ball comes then in from a different direction, and you are aware that you have to put it there, so you don't have the time to turn around. And, you know, what we see from the 70s, where all these great players stepped on the ball and then sprayed a 60-meter pass. This all happens in a few seconds, and... I can understand why the way they play, which is very direct, but in a nice way, because they don't just go long, but they go very direct in terms of one touch, two touch. That's the kind of thing that they would like with Jurgen Klopp.
How long have they had it for?
They started training this summer with it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you think it is genuinely a reason why they are playing so brilliantly, in Europe at least?
It's impossible to know. I mean, okay. They weren't that bad 2 years before wanting the Bundesliga to canter. Now that they've done it in Europe, I'm not sure you can necessarily say there's a causality between the football note and them doing it in Europe. But I'm sure it doesn't hurt.
Oh, okay. But Borussia Dortmund looking absolutely amazing in the Champions League.
Yeah.
And Bayern
less
looking
so in the league.
And less so in the league, where Bayern are in absolutely extraordinary form.
They are. They've won 10 out of 11. And they seem really untouchable this year. If you think about last year, they had a very decent side, and it's just become a much better team compared to last year. There's also, I think, domestically, that view that we cannot possibly allow Dortmund to win a third title. We have to concentrate every single game. The attitude is much better. And, you know, it's not rocket science. If you have the best side and the best attitude, or a very good attitude, you're gonna win almost every game, and that's what they're doing. And in Europe, I think the real you know, the real test will come much later, will come in March, April again, in the quarters and semifinals. But so far, domestically, you know, they're almost at a point where people say, you know, give them the title now and then we can get on with it.
How many points are they clear?
7 points clear of Schalke.
Already? Already. And in Europe, if you were to think this is a good year for a German Champions League win, which of the two teams would you put your money on?
Well, Schalke are still in as well, and they're topping their group. I mean, they won't win it, although they went to the semi-final only 2 years ago with a much worse side that didn't have Huntelaar playing. He was out injured. So they're not a bad team, but Dortmund have looked very good. I think Mourinho was a little bit self-serving when he sort of said, oh, you know, these guys are potential title contenders, because he just picked up 1 point from two games, so he had to sell that somehow to his public, and that was a good way of doing it. I'm not sure they're quite there yet when it comes to really picking up the trophy, but they'll be the kind of team that nobody really wants to play, because they can hurt you and they can surprise you. And I think they're still crucially, they're still surprising people at this level, because they were so poor last year. People didn't quite think they had it in them, and certainly I think Man City at home were completely shell-shocked with what they saw, and even Madrid, to a certain extent, I think, were a little bit overwhelmed.
Mm, all right. Barry?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, it's the FA Cup tie that nobody wanted.
Well, I think a lot of people wanted it.
Did they?
You're talking about MK Dons v AFC Wimbledon.
I certainly am.
AFC Wimbledon fans don't want it.
Mm.
A lot of people seem to think it's great and it's going to be really fascinating.
Peter Winkelmann, for example.
They're calling it the Don's Derby and a grudge match, but it's nothing of the kind. AFC Wimbledon don't want it played. A lot of AFC fans are thinking of boycotting the fixture, and it will be interesting to see what happens, but it's a bit of a shame they got drawn together.
Well, it's the first time the two teams have met, or will meet, since the original Wimbledon. Well, somebody took Wimbledon away from Wimbledon to Milton Keynes and turned it into the MK Dons, and the fans were forced to start all over again, stepping on one or two local toes on their way, as people have been pointing out, but have done fantastically to rise up since then, to the point where they're now clashing, not in the league, but in the cup, with their nemesis. Promising Light says the match nobody wanted goes ahead. It'd be cool if some sort of electron positron, an annihilation thing happened. The two sides emerge onto the pitch, the ref blows his whistle, and blam, no more AFC Wimbledon, no more MK Dons, but in their place, photonic, shining, resplendent and new, the Crazy Gang. Vinny and all. Equally, Kay Wolf says, am I the only one who doesn't feel the need to praise AFC to the hilt? I don't think the way they moved into Kingstonian's turf and subsequently bought their ground was great PR for a side with their history. Yeah, Kingstonian were in financial trouble, but so were Wimbledon when they moved to Milton Keynes. AFC and MK Dons both seem happy with their lot. I don't see why plastics up and down the country feel the need to spill faux rage at MK Dons.
Well, there is a lot of faux rage going on, and I think AFC Wimbledon are in grave danger of doing themselves a lot of PR damage here. They risk becoming known more for their hatred of MK Dons than the good things they've done themselves. And, you know, they also risk their fans being sort of a kind of a schism. Fans who are happy to go to the match and fans who refuse to have anything to do with it.
Hmm.
So, they're not going to come out of this well, whatever happens, I suspect. I think they should just... They've been going for 10 years. They've done very well. Just get on with it and stop complaining about MK Dons.
All right, then.
Just finally, I mean, it's not the big deal everyone's making out. It's an FA Cup second round match between a League One club and a League Two club. You know, the world isn't going to stop turning if some people who support those teams are unhappy.
In other posting news, anyway, we were mentioning players with unusual pre-game or post-game professions. Hey, SQ123 suggests that Closer is a carpenter, and he reckons that he built his own house when he was at Kaiserslautern. Is that right? He turned professional at the age of 24.
That is true.
All right, okay.
I've never heard about him being a carpenter.
Here's some more you might not have heard of. Mikey FC says that Scott Chipperfield, before playing for Wollongong and FC Basel,
ran a circus.
You I'll move on. It was bus driver, but yours is better.
Maestriver.
Daniel Kelly. Sligo Rovers goalkeeper Richard Brush has publicly stated he plans to become an undertaker when his career finishes. Chris Waddle used to work in a sausage factory, says Johnny Five Eyes. Neil Webb, now a postman. World Cup winner Ray Wilson was an undertaker. Best of all, Spurs and Notts County winger John Chidozie is now a vendor of bouncy castles. That's there good. You go. P. Not- Daddy Charlie Austin was a bricklayer before he started playing professionally. He's currently set a record for Burnley by scoring in 8 successive games, having cemented his place, says P. Daddy. Nice work in the Burnley team. Surely his career is pointed towards bigger things. And Amaral, Brazilian journeyman Amaral, says Luke WG. Worked as a gravedigger. You knew that one. A gravedigger.
Do you know what Lothar Matthäus studied before he turned professional?
I don't know.
Interior design.
Interior design, yes. Lothar Matthäus, yes. Lothario Matthäus, yes. Interior design. Yes.
One more time.
I'm tempted. No, that's amazing. That's amazing. I tell you what, hats off to the footballers who got a second string to their bow, another arrow in their quiver, and that they might be archers, in which case they literally would.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. That's probably enough posts, although we should mention Hobbiton FC, who is among the many listeners pointing out that I completely got it wrong about where the Zidane statue with the headbutt is. It's actually outside the Pompidou Centre, and it's not a statue of Zizou per se outside the Stade de France. I really should have checked that before mouthing off in Monday's pod. Good. Oh, and Sayings McSaying saying that the Sydney FC coach was Ian Crook, another fact we didn't check. Great. Lovely. That's it for part two. Coming up shortly, part three. Premier League weekend. It involves Arsenal against Spurs. It involves West Brom Chelsea. It involves QPR Southampton. In the big Mark Hughes Nigel Adkins showdown. Crikey. Big fixtures. Big fixtures, Rafa.
Yes.
What do you want to talk about?
Well, I'm going to the North London Derby now. That is maybe the pick of the bunch.
You know, Spurs are, you Arsenal slumping in the league and trouble in Europe. Spurs arriving looking to extend their lead over their North London rivals. Oh, I'm describing the situation just last year when they went there. Yes. And ended up losing 5-2.
Almost, yeah, I mean, you're right. It has overtones of what happened last season, but they come into this from different positions. I think with Andrea Spohr, she just not quite sure whether this Spurs team have really figured out what he wants from them, whether he's really figured out how to use them, because they're very direct side, the way they're set up. They have, you know, lots of pace in positions where it's probably perhaps not conducive to also have a possession game. So I think he's still trying to marry his vision of what he wants to do to the actual players who excel at very different things. And I think you saw that kind of conflict almost at the away game to City, where they played really well, but then completely lost their shape, where you had people still going forward when it was 1-1, and they were swamped in midfield, and he looked like a man who sort of can't get his message across. And of course with Arsenal, they started from a team who looked so solid in defence, and everyone was hailing the work of Steve Bould on a training pitch to a team who again find it impossible to defend. And of course that has a knock-on effect to the whole side, because if everyone's afraid that every single attack will result in a goal, you can't really play that kind of football that Arsenal want to play. So it's a very open game, and I think one very difficult to predict the result, but one thing you can, I think, predict with some a degree of confidence is a lot of goals.
Well, all right then. Andre Villas Boas, Pedro, another Portuguese with an image problem.
Not as much as last year. He has improved, but I agree. I think he's too intense. And managers like that normally get on players' nerves sooner or later, especially in the modern game. And I also think that he only has a plan A. And the only time he tried the plan B with Adebayor and Defoe was, I know it was against Maribor, but that they just showed a different dimension. I'm not saying they should have played like that at Manchester City, but he should have a look at playing both of those guys together more often.
Will he do that at the Emirates?
I doubt it.
Is he going to go with Adebayor against the Gunners, a former club fighting?
I think you have to start Defoe. He's a better finisher, and especially
in games like that to go along with the pace of the wingers. You need someone like Defoe. I think he made a mistake by not playing Defoe against City, even though Adebayor had a good game. But
I couldn't disagree more with
go
that.
Go on, Ben.
Okay. Defoe's Premier League form is terrible. He scored three against Maribor, but that's just Maribor. You know, I think I'd have scored three in that game if I was
really
getting
unfair.
The service.
This, come on. That Maribor are better than 30% of the teams in the Premier League.
I'll take your word for that, but...
You might score three against 30% of the teams in the Premier League.
No, I probably wouldn't.
All right, then. But
and I just,
I
think a lot
league.
Of people have been clamouring for the inclusion of Defoe, and I just think his form doesn't justify his inclusion.
All right. Fair enough. What about Arsenal? 11 games in the Premier League, 4 wins. Those are numbers. I'm not making this up.
Oh, no. I wasn't accusing you of lying.
All right.
But this is a very interesting fixture, or more interesting than usual, just because both sets of fans are unhappy. Both sets of fans think their team are underperforming and should be in better positions than they are. So if there is a loser of the game, those fans are going to be even more unhappy, and the manager of their team will be under increased pressure, particularly if that manager is André Villas-Boas.
Bold predictions again from Barry Glendening. In other Premier League weekend news, Man City are taking on Aston Villa. Ooh, last time these two teams met, not so long ago, in September in the League Cup, a 4-2 win for Aston Villa. Extraordinary. Yeah.
The League Cup.
The League Cup. All right. So City, no, yeah. City,
what?
Yeah.
No,
good.
Yeah.
Moving along. How dangerous will the trip to Carrow Road prove for Man United? Not that dangerous by the looks of it. No.
You probably have a good chance of making a bit of money if you back Norwich at the half time, because United seem to be one of the poorest teams in the league when it comes to the first 45 minutes. I don't know if the whole team always needs that wake up jolt from Alex Ferguson at halftime, or what the issue is. If it's I have this theory, maybe I'm wrong, Man United fans will know better, but maybe the problem is that the centre backs are no longer, or certainly the centre backs that have on the pitch at the moment, cannot be trusted to be isolated against the opposition strikers. So there's the midfield. I think half of the midfield's time is basically thinking very defensively, trying to make sure that these guys at the back are not exposed, because they're no longer good enough to win those 1v1 battles more often than not. And I think that has a kind of a, to use a Wengerism, a handbrake effect on the way the whole team plays. They play very, very slow, very staid kind of football, and only once they're really going for it and play with a lot more abandon and actually make sure to commit men forward, then we see the invincible or the irresistible.
When they have
United
to go for
machine.
It, when they're forced to into it by going for it. All right, in other news, hey, Festival of Football ahoy at Upton Park as West Ham play Stoke. Whoa, rutting alpha male stags. Ooh, that's right. Don't know who's going to come out on top. It's a man's game, that one, West Ham Stoke.
It's a 1984 game.
Tell you what, all the better for it.
But we have to I think, give Sam Allardyce, or Big Sam, we have to give him some credit, even though maybe begrudgingly, because I think what he is doing this season with West Ham, certainly in terms of result, is pretty special.
Absolutely.
No one would bet an eyelid if they were in 12th, 13th position, but for them to really punch that high is pretty amazing. And I think it does show that whatever you think about him in aesthetic terms or in his sort of general outlooks on the game, he does know how to bring not just the best, but perhaps slightly more than the best out of a squad. And that's really anything you can ask from a manager.
Absolutely.
Doesn't it also mean that the Premier League's actually quite average outside of the top five? I mean, there's a lot of average teams out there.
Yeah, but that's true for most leagues.
As good as Maribor.
No, indeed. With your anti-Premier League agenda here.
No anti-Premier League agenda.
Right.
Just
right.
West Ham up there, really?
Yeah, in sixth place.
Yeah, really? Mm.
Well, I don't know. It's difficult,
but
isn't it?
Hasn't that always been the case? There's like four or five good teams in the Premier League and the rest are all mediocre at best.
I think the gap's getting bigger.
Possibly.
All right. Well, on an entirely different note, how about Liverpool? They're taking on Wigan. Ooh, exciting story in, well, all sorts of papers about Man City with 50 million quid to snap up Luis Suarez, and people say it's a true. It'd be heartbreaking for all his teammates. Who are they going to celebrate with? It's easy to mock.
I think Manchester City supporters might react the same way. I mean, do they really need another,
But surely it would be
striker like that.
Better or more newsworthy if City weren't interested in Luis Suarez. It's like, player doing well at a mid-table club, Manchester City must be interested.
Ooh, that stings. Mid-table Liverpool. Right, Wigan actually won this game at Anfield 2-1 back in March. Another Latics win there at Anfield? A draw? Draw, is it?
I would go for a Liverpool win.
Really?
Not with any level of confidence. I just think at home they should be able to win that game.
All right,
What about West Brom Chelsea?
Oh, I'm coming on to that. I was first going to say Fulham Sunderland, Newcastle Swansea, and Reading Everton, and then I was going to say West Brom Chelsea, Pedro.
I'm really excited about that game because I think Steve Clarke's done excellently there, and they play really good football. I still enjoy watching Chelsea play because those three attacking midfielders are all fantastic. They should have. I was at the Liverpool game last weekend, and they should have finished Liverpool off in that first half. I think Torres continues to be quite poor, and if he wasn't, not as a player, but in form, if he wasn't, that they would be racking up the goals.
All right, great Torres stat that I was quoting you actually, Rafa, yesterday, which was actually came from listener Las7, or Las7, perhaps. He says, Torres touched the ball 42 times in Chelsea's last game. 26 of those 42, i.e. more than half, directly resulted in a turnover, goal kick, or opponent's throw.
It's a good touch. Torres continues to frustrate, I think, himself, but also his teammates, because last year or the year before, we had this whole narrative that the team isn't set up for him. He needs a different kind of style to bring out the best of him. Now they're really very much set up for this kind of striker, and it still doesn't work. He makes some really good runs, you have to give him that, and stuff that you sometimes don't can really appreciate on television, because it sort of happens off telly, off screen. But sometimes you also get the feeling that he doesn't really want to get the ball, doesn't really want to really attack it. He doesn't have that kind of intensity that the very best centre-forwards have, who really sort of will kill you to get that ball, like Luis Suarez, for example, who quite literally probably would, stick a knife in your back. And the thing is, though, with Chelsea, I think they overperformed to a slight extent at the beginning of the season. I think now they're doing exactly what we more or less expected them to do, which is just to be a little bit off the pace behind the two Manchester sides. They are the third best team, I think, when it comes to sort of picking up results regularly. And they're doing more or less what they should be doing. And I think, if anything, again, I think you have to say Roberto Di Matteo has really managed this transition of style, which really is a 180-degree turnaround, very well so far. And we shouldn't expect them to beat everyone all the time and perhaps win the title this year.
Well, having said that, a defeat and two draws in the last three in the Premier League, dropping off the top of the park.
Against very decent teams.
Liverpool, Swansea and Man United. No, I'm not sure. I think Chelsea maybe feel they should have got a little bit more for that. Is it also true that teams have now worked out how to play this new-look Chelsea?
Yeah, they're dropping a bit deeper and not allowing Azar, Oshkar and Mata to run at them so much. But it's still a dangerous proposition when you face those three guys. I also think that the form of Mikel sometimes means that in midfield they don't have as much of an influence as they should. I really like Ramirez. I think Mikel's kind of the odd man out in that midfield. He's just average. That's my word of the day.
He's the only one whose name you pronounce the same way that I would. Fantastic.
Is that why you were? That's why you were
smiling.
Making notes here.
Yeah. No, they're just like, ooh, really? Okay. West Brom, of course, very good at home. There you go.
But that's because they're kind of like Ecuador. It's the altitude thing.
Oh, that's true. Highest ground in the Premier League.
So
Bolivia.
Bolivia. Yeah.
Bolivia, I'm told. Bolivia as well. Ecuador as well. Producer Ben.
No, I used
Peru.
I used to make quite a lot of money betting on Ecuador in World Cup qualifiers.
Right.
Before the bookies kind of cottoned on to it. That it was a weather.
But they haven't sussed out Hawthorns yet, have they?
No.
I'm tapping my nose, Barry. Right. So, but what we're saying basically is Chelsea's rotten run could continue here.
Oh, very much so, yeah. It's going to be really exciting for West Brom fans because I wouldn't imagine, or I would imagine it's been a while since they welcomed Chelsea to the Hawthorns and were confident of getting a result and possibly even the win. I don't think anyone would be surprised if Chelsea lost this game.
I would be very surprised if Chelsea lost this game.
Would you?
I'm sorry.
Fair enough.
I think they'll win.
All right. Lukaku can't because he's on loan at Crazy Premier League.
I just didn't know if that was...
Yeah. Steve Clark, of course, against his former employee, so he won't be celebrating any goals. And that.
Sorry, Rafa, why would you be very surprised?
I wouldn't be.
Oh, he wouldn't be surprised.
Sorry, John, you said...
No, you said
nobody would be surprised.
Nobody would be surprised if Chelsea lost. Yeah. Would you be surprised, Rafa?
I would be surprised because I think Chelsea are a much better side, and the rotten run is only relative to the amazing run that they've had so before. And if two teams meet and one is much better than the other, then they usually win.
But you said that it was understandable and to be expected that they had the results that they had against teams like Swansea and Liverpool. But West Brom...
You left out Man United there.
Man United, yeah. But I mentioned the two that are particularly relevant here because West Brom are doing so much better than either Swansea or Liverpool, and indeed put Swansea and Liverpool together, and West Brom is still doing better, he said, not having checked the numbers because it's probably not true. Anyway, but you're still surprised, Rafa. Yes.
I think Chelsea have got a very good chance of beating West Brom, and I don't think West Brom fans will think, Chelsea, they're awful this season. We're really going to stuff them.
That's not what I said, they think.
All right, let's move on, shall we?
I think you're stuck back in a pod of a few years ago.
Yeah, Rafa.
When Liverpool were a good team.
So. Yeah. Oh, how about QPR Southampton? Now, one reads that this is potentially the decisive match for the fate of one, both, neither manager.
I would say it could be decisive. Well, it almost certainly will be decisive in the fate of either manager if their team loses.
Well, if Southampton lose, do you think Atkins will go?
I think he will go before Christmas if they lose, yes. And I think if QPR lose, Hughes will also go. Right. I can't see them being patient with Hughes for much longer because what he's doing clearly isn't working.
It's a managerial death match, this, isn't it? Wow. They should tie their arms together and give them blades. Stick them in the same circle.
It would probably be more interesting to watch than the game that we're going to see unfold.
I would agree there's more pressure on Hughes simply because he's coming from a very different position into this game. I mean, QPR shouldn't be that low with the resources that they have available. Also, you know, resources also when it comes to attracting managers, or so-called, you know, big names. I mean, Southampton get rid of Atkins. Who can they realistically entice? Who can they sell the project to? Everyone, I think, who's kind of come in will know that at best they'll avoid relegation. Whereas with QPR, you can, at least on paper, promise, you know, you say we'll really rebuild. We have a lot of money here, and we're going to try and challenge for the top half of the table very soon. So I think there's no reason to stick. For that reason, there's no reason to stick with Hughes if you're underperforming and you have the money to get someone else better in. Why not do it?
QPR have the lowest attendance in the Premiership and a lower attendance of quite a few Championship clubs. So I think if you look at it long term, Southampton is probably a better prospect. They spent quite a lot of money during the summer as well. It possibly spent more than...
No, they did. They spent more than QPR if you look at what it cost to bring the players in, not wages.
The wages
is the thing. I have a feeling, though, that QPR will win this game, get their first victory at home to Southampton, and will effectively put a lot of this pressure behind them for Mark Hughes, but I might be wrong.
If QPR don't win this match, I don't know how Mark Hughes will stay. He's the equivalent of us getting together a fantasy team and putting together all these forwards and midfielders and then having, you know, 300K to buy the defenders. I think he completely forgot about that small detail, and they've been abysmal at the back.
Right.
It's his career is on the line here, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. A lot of people saying this week that if he loses this job, that's his career over. That's what you just said. Why do you say that?
Well, he left Fulham because they didn't match his ambition. And now he's at QPR, which clearly did match his ambition, but are doing disastrously badly and at the bottom of the table. He's also not cheap. He brings a large backroom staff. He wants a big budget to spend on players. And I'd say he possibly now is looking back at his time at Fulham and going, maybe I made a big, big mistake.
I think a lot of these, the end of Mark Hughes' window articles are a little bit overstepping the mark. I think if he does go at QPR, given his track record in the past at places like Blackburn, there will be at least a Championship side that'll bring him in for a promotion bid.
There probably will, but I mean, let's not forget there's a time when he was being touted as the next manager of Manchester United.
Right.
You know, and they wouldn't give him the time of day now. He wouldn't even get an interview.
Speaking of not getting an interview, we've had rotten luck getting Sid Lowe on the line. We keep getting his answering machine. Who'd have thought, eh? Let's try one last time before we finish off today's podcast. Ooh, is that Sid Lowe?
Yeah.
Yes, Sid. Yeah, you picked it up thinking it was, I don't know, the butcher or something. Is that embarrassing moment you realise, oh, I really should
James,
have...
James, in my entire life...
Yes?
I don't think I've ever been rung up by the butcher.
Really? But you're
Hello,
in Spain,
would you like
Sid?
Pork chops today?
Yeah.
How long was your phone off for?
Yeah, Sid.
It's ridiculous.
Who have you been talking to?
I have once phoned the butcher, by the way, the butcher of Bilbao and Donny Goikoetxea.
Ah, nice.
But I didn't ask him for a pork chop either.
Right. Who were you on the phone?
I want to know what kind of extravagant lifestyle Jimbo leads where he gets cold calls from butchers
by a butcher, exactly. Jimbo, I'm going to bring that cow around your house.
Okay, you had a sit-down, face-to-face, one-on-one with Johan Cruyff. It was Johan, wasn't it? Not Jordi.
Yeah, and when you said, the thing is, you started that with sit-down, we were both standing up.
Ah, my mistake, right.
But I did speak to Johan Cruyff.
What was it? Was it a scheduled interview, or you passed him in a corridor or shed lift?
It was a little bit of journalistic hickory pokery to make it happen. We're preparing something which will be on the Guardian site next Friday.
What did Johan Cruyff say of interest that you could pre?
Well, we were talking. We talked to him about the meaning and the identity of Barcelona and what his role has been in that and how he's helped to transform the club and change the way that it looks upon things. And he was really interesting speaking in English as well. His English is probably still as good as his Spanish.
All right, then. Sid, that's fantastic. We've come to you right at the end of the show, sadly.
So there's nothing to say.
Is there nothing? I mean,
you're
Spain.
Just say hello. That's very kind of you.
More or less.
And to see if you wanted to buy some pork chops.
Spain had a big win against Panama, but nobody's really that bothered about that. There's probably all sorts of excitement this weekend in the Liga, where, of course, Ronaldo will still be wearing a big patch over his eye, will he?
Well, I don't know about a patch, but it's pretty swollen. He's got one of those, you know, the kind of Steri-Strip style stitching things.
Why doesn't he get a patch?
It would be good, wouldn't
yeah.
it? That would be brilliant. I'd love to see him walk on the pitch with a patch, and preferably with a parrot on his shoulder as well.
Sid, there's a lot of, in my view, fanciful talk of a move for Falcao in the winter break for Chelsea, who in return can give them the equally hot Fernando Torres back. Can you enlighten us?
Diego Simeone says Falcao won't go in January. Falcao's been surprisingly honest throughout his time at Atletico Madrid, and I think there's no pretense that at some stage he'll move on. I don't think it'll be January. There's also, I think it's slightly problematic, the idea of Torres going back to Atletico Madrid, because although, of course, you know, it's the club where he's brought up, and I'm sure he'd love to, Atletico Madrid couldn't pay him the kind of salary he's on at Chelsea. His relationship with some elements of the Atletico Madrid board, I think, would make a return, not impossible, but difficult. So I don't see it happening.
All right, Sid, magnificent stuff. Brief and to the point, as always. Sorry we weren't able to get you earlier. But on Monday, look forward to a special Sid roundup of all the weekend's events.
Okay, I'll speak to you on Monday.
Lovely stuff, Sid. Cheerio. And that really is all we have time for today, ever so sadly. But there you go. Barry Glendinning, thanks ever so much for being here, being part of the magic.
You're welcome.
CNN's Pedro Pinto.
Loved it, thank you.
Thank you very much. Everywhere's Raphael Honigstein.
Thank you.
Great. Producer Ben at the Wheels of Steel, you the listener, and we'll be back on Monday. There's a paper review about, I'm not sure what, but there's going to be some Zlatan in it, up on Friday morning. And anyway, we'll see you soon.
The Guardian Masterclasses are now accessible as video downloads and streams. For our podcast listeners, we have a special offer on the great science writer Tim Radford's masterclass. Normally £3 to stream or £5 to download. we are offering 10% off, and all you have to do is use our podcast listeners' discount code, ScienceSave, all one word, and check out all our Guardian masterclasses at guardian.co.uk.